The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Folks, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show, sponsored by Legacy Precious Metals. There's never been a better time to invest in precious metals. Visit LegacyPMInvestments.com. That's LegacyPMInvestments.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. Do you like your gravy thick and rich and loaded with creamy mushrooms? If no one was looking, would you chug the whole gravy boat?
Chug, 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 chug.
Stay tuned. Here comes Mr. Chug-a-Lug himself, Eric Metaxas.
Hey, folks, in 2019, I interviewed the great Mark Helprin for Socrates in the City. This is a special encore presentation. Enjoy.
In Judaism, there is a there are many branches. Of course, there's the conservative, the reform, who are Democrats, and there are conservatives who are Democrats, and there are the Orthodox who are Republicans, and among the Orthodox there are the Hasidim. And you know those guys with the black hats, the diamond merchants, etc.
They're Tea Party.
Their Tea Party, yeah. They are the spine of Judaism. I serve as, also I protect them in the Chabad houses. I'm a consultant to them, and I have done protection duty for them because of the massacres in India, etc. But I can't practice it. I don't feel comfortable with that. But I come from a Hasidic background. My ancestors were Hasidic rabbis. And the division between Hasidism and the other Jewish denominations, if you call them that, is that in Hasidism, you have a direct connection to God. You have to study, too. You see, that I don't do. I don't know Talmud, Torah, etc. I can read the Bible in Hebrew, but not very well, certainly not fluently, not as I should if I were a real Hasid. But the whole point of Hasidism is that there is a direct connection without the kind of formal remediation intermediation that you get in other forms of Judaism. But they study hard, but you don't need to study hard, actually. You can experience it right at the well. So that's what I followed. What was the question? Yeah. Oh, what's right? Okay.
Meaning of life.
Yeah. What's right? Well, I mean, it's just like religion. You have many ways of approaching it and judging it, and we're all fallible. So you can't be too confident in what is right, because you may be wrong. We've all been wrong, and sometimes seriously. God knows I have. But you make it a combination of the logic and reason and experience, and drawing upon others, considering other opinions, and then your gut feeling, finally. And that's, you make a combination of that, and then when you feel that you've arrived at a certain conclusion, you're ready to risk doing what you have to do in order to protect it.
Well, I still think that the reason that it was startling for me to discover that you were rather politically conservative and a fiction writer is because most fiction writers don't have that fierce moral quality in their writing. They're writing typically as, I would say, maybe run-of-the-mill utopianists who believe that, in fact, we're not fallen, that we're evolving from something to higher levels, and that we can, I guess it was William F. Buckley who talked about it, but he was quoting someone else, when you talk about immanentizing the eschaton, right? That if we have enough taxes and we have enough government, we can fix everything and we can create utopia, through social engineering or whatever it is. And we know that history, especially recent modern history, is replete with examples of people trying to achieve that. So when you say something like we're fallible, or you know, that morality is a struggle, or this or that, you realize that you're parting company with most of the people who create art in our time. So
yeah, well, they are afraid of a number of things. First of all, they're afraid to be ambitious. So they sort of imbibe the academic tendency to particularize. The American Academy is divided between the English approach and the German approach. In the 19th century, we had to choose. Harvard chose to lean toward the English approach, which value good writing, graceful exposition, and generalization. Johns Hopkins was the big leader, and Columbia followed, in valuing the German approach, which was to be very particular, strict, and limited, rigorous. See, it's a question of richness versus rigor. And writers today have inherited the rigorous approach, which means that they limit their ambitions, just the way scholars limit their ambitions. You know, the penis denial in Belgian circus stories as a thesis. And that the fiction cousins of that are, you get these novels which are like magazine articles. They deliberately limit them. It's almost like John McPhee, but it's a novel. You know, and the novel might be called Estonian Rug Merchant's Baboon, or the
girl. That's perfect. That's perfect. Yeah. That doesn't really exist.
No,
that
no.
Sounds like a novel that the New Yorker would just go crazy.
Of course,
and then of course, it's got just enough exoticism. Yeah. Or just enough, but not too much.
And it's
right?
Kind of limited, you know. I mean, if you're talking only about a baboon that belonged to an Estonian rug merchant,
right.
You're defining it closely
but
down.
But that's as far into transcendence as like New Yorker type fiction wants to go.
That's exactly
right. Like
the
rug merchant alone, the idea of a rug merchant, he's sort of, you know, close to the world somehow. He's a rug merchant. But that's as far. Also in the poetry that's published in the New Yorker, it's interesting because it's just part of the zeitgeist. And I mean, you're explicating it. But
they're afraid. They're afraid to take a chance. They're afraid to put a marker down and say, this is what I stand for. This is what I love. This is what I would die for. Some things are good, some things are not. Some things are beautiful, some things are not. They're terribly frightened. They're cowards. I mean, I can't generalize and say everyone, but so many. And that is the zeitgeist in modern. I have been criticized so often these days. They say he uses such big words, you know, and I don't. I mainly keep to Anglo-Saxon vocabulary. But they say, the sentences are too long. The descriptions are too. There's too much description. People have been trained to inhale nihilism. There's a form of nihilism, like the minimalists. The minimalists, like Ray Carver.
Carver.
They don't like richness of language. They don't like metaphor. They don't like occult meter.
But there's a reason for that, right? In other words, when you talk about minimalists and nihilism, they are in some ways at war with a past, right? In other words, you think of a past where all the typefaces had serifs and all the buildings had moldings and whatever, they hate that because it somehow bespeaks a patriarchal Christian Western order that inescapably points to God. And they are trying to carve their own minimalist path out of that. So any hint toward morality or good or evil, it's disturbing. And that's why I'm, you know, you must be a great writer just to have snuck so much of this past these watchful dragons.
Well, it's quite easy to fool a publisher at lunch. Because they drink, so much.
Yeah.
And also, it does pay to have a business sense. You know, publishers are very slow to pick up on things, and they're not always the brightest bulbs.
Why don't we just say that they're stupid?
They're stupid, yeah.
I mean, in the interest of time.
If you're not going to be a lawyer, you're not going to be a doctor, you're not going to be a physicist, you're not going to be an engineer, you're not going to be a businessman where you have to take risks and actually see what's going to happen in the future and do all kinds of finance stuff. And so what do? You go into publishing. That used to be.
I'm horrified. Many publishing friends are here. Don't leave, friends. Yeah. Don't leave, because I'll defend you in 5 minutes.
Remember as a kid, your parents and grandparents making you try all the vegetables on your plate, or when they coax you to eat fruit instead of sweets? That's because they knew what was good for you, and it's truer today than ever before. You need to eat your fruits and veggies. There's no substitute for a healthy diet, but there is Balance of Nature. Their products are gluten-free and non-GMO, and they contain no added sugars or synthetics. If you're looking for something to make you feel better naturally, you should definitely try Balance of Nature today. Eat your fruits and veggies every single day with Balance of Nature. I started taking Balance of Nature the day I decided I was ready to feel better. Are you ready to start? Whether you order online or call them direct, you must use the promo code ERIC to get the special offer of 35% off. Call them at 800-2468-751 and use discount code ERIC, or order online at balanceofnature.com. Use discount code ERIC to get 35% off. I'll say it again, 800-2468-751. Use discount code ERIC, or order online at balanceofnature.com. Use discount code ERIC to get 35% off. Legacy Precious Metals has a revolutionary new online platform that allows you to invest in real gold and silver online. In a few easy steps, you can open an account online, select your metals of choice, and choose to have them stored in a vault or shipped to your door. You have access to a dashboard where you can track your portfolio growth in real time, anytime. You'll see transparent pricing on each coin and bar. This puts you in complete control of your money. The platform is free to sign up for. Visit legacypminvestments.com and open your account and see this new investing platform for yourself. Gold hedges against inflation and against a volatile stock market. A true diversified portfolio isn't just more stocks and bonds, but different asset classes. This new platform allows you to make investments in gold and silver, no matter how small or large, with a few clicks. Visit legacypminvestments.com to get started. You're going to love this free new tool they've added, legacypminvestments.com. Legacypminvestments.com. Check it out. Dare to challenge the status quo with the movie The Real RFK Jr. Watch it for free for a limited time now at therfkmovie.com. The Real RFK Jr. movie is based on the in-depth biography by New York Times bestselling author Dick Russell, brought to life by award-winning filmmaker Jeff Hayes. Explore the highs and lows of a life dedicated to making a difference. Witness the fearless advocacy of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Don't miss your chance to watch the untold story of a modern-day hero free for a limited time at therfkmovie.com. Go to the rfkmovie.com today. Some truths are worth fighting for. For a limited time, watch The Real RFK Jr. movie free at the rfkmovie.com, rfkmovie.com. Portions of the Eric Metaxas Show are brought to you in part by Jeff Hayes Films and The Real RFK Jr. movie. To be clear, the website is rfkmovie.com, rfkmovie.com. This is a special Socrates in the City presentation with the great Mark Helprin. Yeah.
But this is you're being serious, right? In other words, you're saying that you were aware of this going into writing fiction, that you're bringing something into it that you have to disguise.
What? Well, no, I wasn't aware in the beginning because I'm old enough so that I started when the terms were different. I started in 1964. I went to Harper and Row and met a woman there named Joan Kahn, who was a great fiction editor, and started to submit to her, and they would get back to me.
You were what, 17?
Yeah.
Okay. Why? What?
I'll tell you, because my parents didn't read to me. That's why I said earlier that I hadn't read Charlotte's Web. I hadn't read many children's books.
Charlotte's Web.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was I had a room on Central Park West that had a black linoleum floor. There were no toys in it and no books. And that's where I stayed most of the time.
It sounds like a Skinner box.
Well, it was solitary confinement. And because they were gone. My father lived in England for 6 months of the year. My mother was an actress. She was always on the road. And I was kept in that room, and that's where I learned to be. For instance, when I go to Europe, I can sit and watch a fountain for 8 hours, 17 hours. I can do that. I don't mind. I like it. When I got to first grade, and it was at the Birch Wathen School, which in those days was on the west side, I was the only kid who didn't know how to read. They all had been pushed by their parents, who were all Jews in the movie business. And they wanted, it's like the kids now who are tutored to get into fancy kindergartens so they can go to Harvard eventually. They were pushed by their parents, and they came in limousines, etc. And I didn't know the alphabet. So I remember I walked in, Mrs. Smith was my teacher, and she said, go to the desk with your name on it. And I said, I can't read. And she said, okay, well, what is your name? I told her my name. She said, find the M. And I said, what's an M? And all the kids laughed at me. Ha ha, right? So I was really pissed by
that. You made a monkey out of those kids, huh?
Yeah, I was really pissed. And by second grade, I was reading beyond 12th grade level.
Out of sheer spite.
Out of sheer spite, yeah. And in third grade, I began dictating stories to my third grade teacher, who would write them in longhand. And then Simon & Schuster offered me a two-book contract in third grade to write a biography of Abraham Lincoln. And a children's...
Wouldn't you love to know what a third grader's biography of Abraham... I'd pay for that.
Yeah. Well, they thought it was going to be in golden books. And a children's story about a mouse, which would have been essentially copped from Stuart Little. But
right, right.
My father said no, because my mother had been a child star. And he said, look what it did to her. So I'm not going to let you do this.
Look what it did to her.
Yeah. Oh, it did to her, believe me. But what was the question?
What's capital of North Dakota?
Bismarck.
Okay. All right. Well, no, that tells
yeah,
it.
Yeah, Pierre, South Dakota.
But wait a minute. So you were, you're leading up actually to a question I want to ask, but you were talking about how you were raised in a room with black linoleum and how you really were not, you were left to yourself,
yeah,
effectively.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And do you now, you seem very cheerful. It doesn't strike me that you're thinking of this as neglect or something that you, or maybe it was neglect, but you simply aren't bitter about it. But it sounds like neglect, no?
No, it wasn't neglect.
What was it?
It was neglect.
Yeah, but in the best sense of neglect.
But,
yeah.
But my parents, I love my parents. And in fact, I was crazy because, I spent most of my life, while my father was alive, I can see why they did this, because they probably knew what was coming. I spent most of my life tailing my father, asking him questions about his life. So I feel, and I do, as if I were born in 1904, because I have spent tens of thousands of hours listening to every detail of his life. And he had a photographic memory. He was famous for it. Someone could say to him, for example, when was the last time you were on 26th Street between 3rd and 4th Avenue? And he would say, it was in, this would be in the 1950s, he would say it was December 17th, 1936. And they would say, describe it. And he could tell you everything that was in the store windows, the cracks in the side, everything. He had a complete photographic memory. So I trailed him, beginning when I was very little, asking him questions about starting from his earliest memories, and he lived a very adventurous, interesting life. So essentially, that's why probably they put me in the room with the linoleum, because they knew that I'd be pestering them.
Right, and he needed to catch a break, and that was the only way he could get away from you. Well, it's interesting. This brings up another quality in your fiction. It does seem to be of another time. You don't write thank the Lord like most contemporary writers. And yeah. I think it's why reading you, it's like reading someone from a different generation than you are. And so now at least we have some explanation of where that came from.
Yeah, and in The Soldier of the Great War, which is about a 74-year-old man, strangely enough, so is Paris. He's also 74. Right. I wrote A Soldier of the Great War beginning in 1980 when I was, 33. And I've always felt like a much older person because I've sort of absorbed my father's age. And I also... I know what this was about originally. I started in a different time, and I'm a throwback to a different time, and I never succumbed to the pressure to conform to this time, simply because it's not worth it. And, you know, and you shouldn't ever do anything that you would lose sleep over or that you'd feel bad about.
Well, let me ask you, you know, when you you obviously came of age in the 60s.
Yeah.
You graduated Harvard in 69?
69.
Okay,
well, it graduated me.
Who cares? From Harvard. Yeah. The question is, you know, you ought to be, you're the classic boomer, you're supposed to fit into that mold, and you obviously don't. You don't strike people as somebody who would have been a hippie at that time or that kind of a person. And not only that, but then you joined the Israeli, is it Air Force?
Army, infantry, and then Air Force. I was seconded to the Air Force as an infantryman.
Is seconded how they say it in the West Indies?
No, that's how they say it. Yeah, I guess so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my question is, why did you do that? Because that seems like exactly the kind of thing pot smoking draft dodgers of your generation would not do, right? It's really very countercultural and strikingly.
Well, I was swimming in the Harvard Sea, which, and by the way, when I was 17, I was going through Greece and I met a guy whose name was Alpert, who was a Harvard assistant, maybe he was a graduate student then, but I think he was an assistant professor, the lowest rank of a professor. And he and I walked across the Peloponnesus, and we slept in barns, and we ate in people's houses, in goat's milk and that kind of stuff.
How old were you?
17. And he turned out to be Robert Alpert, otherwise known as Baba Ramdas, or Ramdas, as I call him.
Okay, for those who don't know who that is, this is one of the leading gurus of the New Age movement, invented New Age in America.
And when he was an associate of Timothy Leary, and they developed LSD.
For 10 years, Patriot Mobile has been America's only Christian conservative wireless provider. And when I say only, trust me, they're the only one. Glenn and the team have been great supporters of this show, which is why I am proud to partner with them. Patriot Mobile offers dependable nationwide coverage, giving you the ability to access all three major networks, which means you get the same coverage you've been accustomed to without funding the left. When you switch to Patriot Mobile, you're sending the message that you support free speech, religious freedom, the sanctity of life, Second Amendment, and our military, veterans, and first responder heroes. Their 100% U.S.-based customer service team makes switching easy. Keep your number, keep your phone, or upgrade. Their team will help you find the best plan for your needs. Just go to patriotmobile.com/Metaxas, patriotmobile.com/Metaxas, or call 972-PATRIOT, 972-PATRIOT. Get free activation when you use the offer code Metaxas. Join me, make the switch today. That's patriotmobile.com/Metaxas.
Hey, this is Eric Metaxas. For years, I've told you about Nutramedics, a professional supplement brand trusted by doctors since 1993. Nutramedics offers a variety of health bundles, whether you want to support your immune system, improve your sleep, promote joint comfort, or detoxification support. Nutramedics has a health bundle right for you. The best part about Nutramedics, every year they donate a minimum of 50% of their profits to Christian charities and missions. That's right, 50% of their profits. Nutramedics has a goal of surpassing $100 million in giving by 2030. Many of you take supplements already. Switch to Nutramedics. It's the highest quality, and they donate 50% of their profits. Get 15% off by using the code ERIC during checkout. Go to Nutramedics.com and search health bundles. Support your health while helping others in need. Go to Nutramedics. That's Nutramedix.com. Nutramedics.com. Use the code ERIC for 15% off. Again, Nutramedics, Nutramedix.com. Nutramedics.com. Use the code ERIC for 15% off.
Hey, folks, in 2019, I interviewed the great Mark Helprin for Socrates in the City. This is a special encore presentation. Enjoy.
So when I was a freshman, I was put in a place called Pennypacker, which was a sort of a modern building. It wasn't in the yard. It was a sort of exiled. That was the worst possible place you could be. And Alpert lived on Harvard Street, which is where Pennypacker was, just a couple blocks up. So I ran into him, and then I went to see him in his apartment, and he said, "You want to smoke a joint?" I didn't know what it was. I've never tasted coffee in my life. I don't like things like that. And I said, "No. What is it?" He said, "Oh, it's great." I said, "No, I don't want it." He said, "You want some LSD?" And I said, "What is LSD?" And he said, "Well, it's this new thing. You put it on a sugar cube. We invented it. Whatever." I hated the idea of drugs, and so I from that, even then, even as a freshman, I was different. But I did swim in the political sea, and was very much against the Vietnam War. I gave a speech at West Point to the Corps of Cadets, apologizing for not taking my place, because although I was against the war, I don't think that I was my own legislature. And I should have fulfilled my duties as a citizen. So that speech is in the congressional record. It's been printed all over the place. The reason that happened was I was sitting on the grave of William and Henry James in the Mount Auburn Cemetery. It faces south so that it's sheltered from the northern wind, and also the sun shines in the south. I was writing the first story that I published in New Yorker called Leaving... Well, actually, the first one that was actually published was called Because of the Waters of the Flood, but the first story that I wrote that they bought was called Leaving the Church. And Henry James was there, William James was there. I was sitting on Henry's grave, leaning against the family bedstead grave marker. And a funeral in Cambridge Cemetery, which adjoins Mount Auburn, which is where Mary Baker Eddy is buried and a lot of famous people. But the Cambridge Cemetery is for the proletarians. And a funeral came and they buried somebody. And then they left, and I went to see who was buried, and it was a boy my age who had been killed in Vietnam. And that really, really struck me. And from that point on, I decided that I wanted to do something of that nature. I had already been 4F, but it was fake. When I took an EEG, I can make electrical pulses in my body that make the needles go whap, 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 whap.
You can do that?
I can do that.
Can you teach others how to do that?
Maybe, but you don't have to worry. You're too old for the draft. I can also... Now, my wife will have to verify this because no one will believe it. Say what I do about horses. Okay, so that's what she says. She's crazy. anyway, I had made myself 4F, and I felt very bad about that. So then I went to Israel and joined the army. We were fighting Russians, and we were fighting... my cousin.
Wait, why did you do that? In other words, you're obviously ethnically Jewish, but you were not raised in a home that was religiously Jewish. What prompted you at that time to go to Israel and fight?
Two words: never again. The Holocaust. In 1967, which is when I went first, they the state was threatened with annihilation. And I just didn't want that to happen, so I wanted to do my piece, and I did. But anyway, I tried to join the Marines too, but I had already been 4F. They wouldn't let me do it.
I want to ask you about, do you think there's something inherent in Jewishness that, and that's, gosh, it's so sloppy even to talk that way, but I guess the moral quality of your fiction, even before I knew that you'd fought in the Israeli army, struck me as coming out of being a Jew, because being a Jew obviously comes with certain experiences, and you often have characters who are, I guess they remind me, I'm always sure that they're autobiographical, and it's they're very romantic. There's a lot of love. It's beautiful love. It's not sexual. That itself is rare. But it struck me that somehow it feels to me like something that I've noticed in other Jewish stories, usually movies. Woody Allen, in some of his best films, has this. It's interesting. He doesn't come out where you do. But it's interesting to me that you're very much of a romantic. Has that been something that you've thought much about, is who you are as a Jew? I mean, you just said never again. So this was something that meant a lot to you.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful.
You might have heard Mike Lindell and MyPillow no longer have the support of their box stores or shopping channels the way they used to. Yes, it's because of cancel culture, but as a result, they get to pass the savings on to you directly by having a $25 extravaganza. When Mike started MyPillow, it was just a one-product company. With the help of his dedicated employees, they now have hundreds of products, some you may not even know about. To get the word out, I want to invite my listeners to check out their $25 extravaganza. Two-pack multi-use MyPillows, just $25. MyPillow sand. $25. There's six-pack towels, just $25. Brand new four-pack dish towels, you guessed it, just $25. For the first time ever, the premium MyPillows with all new Giza fabric, just $25. Orders over $75 will receive free shipping too. The amazing offer will not last long. Go to MyPillow.com, use promo code ERIC, or call 800-978-3057. That's promo code ERIC, 800-978-3057, promo code ERIC, or go to MyPillow.com and use promo code ERIC. This is a special Socrates in the City presentation with the great Mark Helprin.
Yeah, I mean, my father's family came from a little village near Minsk called Koidniev. And when we lived in upstate New York, we had a farm in Kinderhook, New York, a huge farm. And it was 32, on September 1st, when we took the kids to school for the first time, there was snow on the ground. September 1st. And that winter it was 32 below. The pool fence was covered by the early October, and we didn't see it again until May. I mean, it was a hell of a winter. But anyway, at the edge of our farm, far away, was a auto repair shop. And in the auto repair shop, which was really miserable, freezing cold and dirty with oil, et cetera, they had people working on cars, but it was a sort of like a very primitive type thing. And I went down there once to talk about our car, and I was wearing boots and gray pants and a gray 6040, and I had a gray Stetson, and I had my pistol on, and I had a giant dog who was a Bernese Mountain Dog named Constance. And I walked into this place, and one of the mechanics reared back. He almost threw himself against the wall because he was terrified, because he thought I was a state cop and he was frightened of cops. Why, he was a Russian and he didn't have teeth, and his name was Igor, and it turns out he was a Jew from the area. And I said to him, my family came from Koidniev, do you know it? He said it's just a stone. I said the stone? And he meant, you know, like a gravestone. And it turns out that the Einsatzgruppen the special group, the Germans, they would get trucks, put people in the trucks, and then put the exhaust back into the trucks, drive to a pit where they would just throw all the dead people. And they killed every single person in the village. And these were all my relatives. We were lucky. My family escaped. We came here in 1870. That doesn't leave you. You know, in the Second World War, we had 32 people who served, one of whom, my cousin Robert, died in his fighter plane. My father volunteered at age, when he went into the OSS stuff, when he was 36. He was past draft age. And so I felt the same way. And I feel the same way about America, too. I mean, if America were threatened now, I would volunteer. Oh, 71, they're not going to take me. But I do serve, actually, now in an armed capacity. I'll be retiring in 2 years.
Time flies when you're having fun, so we don't have a lot of time left. I wanted to ask you to tell the story of meeting, hanging out with John Cheever as a kid. You have such a storied life that it makes your fiction seem almost dull. And your fiction is not even close to dull. But you really do have, and you're aware of that, having an outrageously storied life and of having met the kind of people when you were already a kid that most people don't get to meet in their lifetime.
Winston Churchill.
You met Churchill?
Yeah, when I was very little at Lake Annecy in, I think it was 1951 or whatever. My father, who had worked for him in the war, we were in Annecy too, and my father was taking something to him from Alexander Korda, who was my father's business partner. And I rode on my father's leg, and we waited in an anteroom with a stone floor with a lot of other men, most of whom were British, in suits. And then the doors opened, and Winston Churchill came out. And I was still riding in my father's, standing on his shoes and holding onto his leg. But about Cheever? I can tell you about Cheever.
Yeah, quickly, because I want to ask you about Winter's Tale. This is ridiculous. Go ahead.
Actually, it turns out that Theodore Roosevelt invented this thing called straight lining. At Sagamore Hill, he would have his kids go in a straight line no matter what, climb over a wall, crawl through a swamp or whatever. I didn't know this, but I invented it for myself when I lived in Eagle Bay, which was in Ossining, about 1,000, 2,000 acres of more or less forest. And I had the idea just independently that I would go in a straight line. So one day...
You know you're nuts, right?
Yeah. I was walking to school. I used to walk 5 miles to school and 5 miles back. And later, I had actually...
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
That it was 5 miles there and 5 miles back. And
the funny thing
was... What are
the
odds of that? It's amazing.
Sometimes it wasn't.
Okay, all right.
Because I would take a different route.
Okay.
Yeah. But what I meant was that I would not only walk to school, but also back.
Right.
One day, I was running a little late, and John Cheever came by in his Nash Rambler, the color of Pepto-Bismol. And he opened the door and said, Marco, because my name was Marco then. He said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm walking to school. He said, well, you'll be late. And I said, would you like a ride? So I said, okay. So I got in the car, and we rode to school. Because he had lived in the garage above the garage on the school grounds with his family.
Now, did you know at the time that he was a famous writer?
Yeah, we all knew. His kids went to the same school, and people knew. He was deathly poor at the time. And my parents knew. They were friends with him. So I got in the car, and he said, why do you walk? And I was telling him, and I told him about straight lining. The next thing I know, there was this story called The Swimmer about Burt Lancaster who did a straight line. But that's okay. I mean, people borrow.
In all seriousness, your conversation with Cheever influenced him to write The Swimmer.
Yes, for sure. And so
hold it right there.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's one of the greatest short stories of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And the fact that you may have had something to do with it, apart from writing, is really something.
I bet if Susie and Benji knew about this, they would probably attack me and say, oh, it's not true, but it is true.
Well, in the story, and I remember Cheever better than I remember your fiction, He talks about taking a dog leg at some point.
Oh, I never read the story.
So you're a liar.
I've never read any.
There's
of
another
it.
Story about when they he
wrote.
Talks,
he wrote a book about my family called Bullet Park. We lived in Brayton Park, and when Martin Luther King was killed, there were riots in Ossining, and they were burning down the stores and stuff, and people attacking people's houses. So my father and I went, and we bought ammunition, and then Mary and John Cheever came to brunch. And they said, you know, this was the time when there's riots going on. And we said, yeah, we bought ammunition. And the Cheever said, you what? Why? In case people come to try to burn our house down. And they said, you would shoot people who were going to kill you? You know, and the answer was, yeah.
This is a special Socrates in the City presentation with the great Mark Helprin.
But I got to get to the red meat, okay?
Uh-huh.
And that is that when I published my first book, which is called The Dove of the East, it was published by Knopf, and I had a lot of stories from The New Yorker in it. I was quite young, and I came home from New York after having an editorial conference with Rachel McKenzie, who was a New Yorker, one great New Yorker editor. And I was on the train. I was reading Carlos Baker's biography of Hemingway. I thought that would be my life. You know, it was in the old days. I thought things were going to be different. And I got home, and I took off my suit. I think it was this one. And I saw John Cheever out by the pool, because they didn't have a pool.
And this had to be 1978?
No, it was 1975. 74. It was 1974. And he was sitting by the pool. So I figured, well, hey, I have the same publisher. He knows I published in The New Yorker. If he reviews it, it'll go on the front page of the New York Times Book Review, my first book. So I went down to him, and I said, hi, John. And I mixed this up with when I went down, and he had written
the Faulkner.
Faulkner,
yeah,
which he pronounces Faulkner. I called it Falconer, being right. You know a pro, and he said, "Hi, Mark," and I said, "Hi," and he said right off the bat, he said, "You know, Faulkner was so and so and so and so." You know, saying something good, won the National Book Award.
National Book National Award. Book no, Award. You told him that Faulkner.
No, 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 no. I remember. He said something about it, and then I said, "Big deal. Faulkner won the Nobel Prize."
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Because I thought he was saying Faulkner. He's saying
now,
Falconer.
We have to slow this down because people may be missing. This is very funny. Yeah. John Cheever. Who spoke with this plummy South Shore Boston accent, pronounced his book Falconer
as
Faulkner. So when he said that,
when he said Faulkner,
you thought he was talking about William Faulkner.
And he said Faulkner was, you know, made the Faulkner
something
won the
special,
something prize.
And you said, yeah. Big deal.
Said,
Faulkner
big deal.
Won it, the Nobel
Faulkner
Prize.
Faulkner won the Nobel Prize. And he went like this. For a second, you know. It was summer. It was June. It was before Nobel Prize season. But he still went like that, so thinking, oh, it did? You know.
And that was later in the 70s.
Yeah, that
because
was,
Faulkner
I guess I
confused. Came out at, right.
Yeah,
okay,
I confused them. But and people, Craig Claiborne said to me once at dinner at his house, he said, Mark, he spoke like this, he said, is John Cheever gay? And I said, oh, no. He said, because he understands about homosexual love. And I said, well, I've known him since I was a child. He's not gay. See, it shows what I knew. So anyway, I go down to the in a different time, and I say, you know, I have a book out. Could you review it for the Times? Thinking, you know, this is going to be it. And he said, well, Mark, he said, actually, Saul and I are coming out with books this fall, and we've pledged not to review any other books. And I felt at that moment both A, really angry that he wasn't going to do this for me. And I had known him all my life, and I'd given him the idea for the swimmer, which was his big thing. And also ashamed that I wanted to be in that system of back scratching that I was angry about. And I decided right then, at that moment, I would never write a blurb for anybody. I would never ask anybody for a blurb. I would never serve on a prize jury. I would never go to Yaddo or anything like that. I would never have anything to do with any writers whatsoever. And I've kept that promise.
Folks, thank you for listening to our encore presentation of Socrates in the City. Go to SocratesInTheCityPlus.com for more, and see you next time.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.